This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is Tom Risen, an aviation reporter who covers airlines, regulation, and electric flight at Cirium. We talk about the Boeing 737 MAX, including the congressional investigations, changing the certification process, and regulatory agency harmony. Tom also talks about Canadian airline mergers and green aviation. In the news, we discuss Chinese development of their commercial aircraft industry, the collapse of Thomas Cook, the Belgian F-16 crash, and Chuck Yeager's lawsuit against Airbus. We also have part five of Launchpad Marzari's quest to buy an airplane. This time he describes importing the plane from Canada. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 571 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
Hi, everybody. Looks like we're going to have a good show tonight. It's hotter than heck, so you might hear some air conditioning going on behind us, but I'm looking forward to an interesting conversation.
Yes. Also with us is Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast, a CFI of the year, and an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hi, Max.
Max, hello, and hello, David. And this was a fun weekend for me. It was my birthday, so it was just a fun time hanging out at the beach and not flying, which is actually fun for a change.
Wow, 49, huh?
No, 59 now.
15.
Or is it 39? I always get it confused.
It's one of those, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Changes from year to year. Our guest this episode is Tom Risen. He's an aviation reporter who covers the airlines, regulation, and electric flight at Cirium. Now, Tom's been a journalist for quite a while. He's been a technology and business reporter at U.S. News and World Report, staff reporter for Aerospace America, worked at Future Flight News, and he has a Master's of Science in Journalism from Northwestern University. Tom, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I like your podcast a lot. I'm glad to be a part of it.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you. Obviously, we've seen a lot of your articles, things that you've written about the industry, and you keep close watch on several aspects of it that we're going to get into. But first, maybe tell us a little bit about Cirium. It's C-I-R-I-U-M. It's a name that not everybody is familiar with.
Yeah, that's the brand name. We've been going through a branding transition recently. So they changed the name for Cirium a few months ago. And we're owned by the same parent company, Reed Business Information. It's based in London. It owns many great database services like LexisNexis, Elsevier, Law360. And so we are the aviation database. We do a lot of analysis and fleet information, like anything you could want to know about an airline, all the planes they own, all the planes they have on order, where their planes are in storage. It's all of it, all their routes, everything. So we have a lot of data at our fingertips to do good aviation journalism. And Flight Global was part of our company until recently, and we had a divestiture. DVV Media bought the Flight Global name, and we have a content sharing partnership. We still work with them, but they are a separate company now.
All right. Very good. Looking forward to diving into some of the things that you've been watching closely. Keepers of the data. I think, you know, he who has the data has the power, I think. And so we'll find out how you guys are leveraging that.
It's great. Anytime there's like a press release, you know, because people will churn press releases. Anytime there's one of those, I just look and say, okay, what data do we have about this? What kind of planes do they have? You know, like anything. I can just pad a press release with any kind of information about this company. It's great.
Wonderful. I wish I had access to something like that.
You can on Ethereum.
Yes. Okay. we're going to learn how to do that coming up. But first, let's talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
First item comes from Seeking Alpha. This is China starts attack on Boeing and Airbus. Wow, sounds pretty dramatic. Well, last week we were talking about a Chinese aircraft and we went off on the C919, but I think what we should have said was the regional ARJ-21 jet, because that's the one that just received an order from both China Eastern Airlines and China Western Airlines for the ARJ-21-700 regional jets. These, of course, come from COMAC, the Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China. Here's COMAC in a nutshell. They started with the ARJ-21 regional jet, which is kind of like a McDonnell Douglas MD-80 or 90. And this is kind of the first step in the Chinese airframe industry trying to build itself. So it starts with the ARJ-21. And then, of course, we've talked a lot about over the years about the C919. And that's the narrow body, which is in the Boeing 737/A320 class of aircraft. And then, as I mentioned last week, there's also the C929, which is a long range wide body, 250 to 320 roughly passengers. But actually, what we've been calling the C929 is now called the CRAIC CR929. I guess that's CRAIC, C-R-A-I-C, because that's a 50-50 joint venture between COMAC and the Russian United Aircraft Corporation. And that venture was launched in 2017. So COMAC is kind of struggled a bit to establish itself, not only with the C919, but going back to the ARJ-21. I guess they've had some certification issues as the Chinese aviation industry has begun to learn how to do that on the global scale. I guess deliveries for this ARJ-21 regional jet are scheduled to begin next year in 2020 at some point and run through 2024. Those are the deliveries to the China Eastern and China Western. The Chinese are, I think they have a lot of patience, and it's been a great many years since the C919 effort started, not to mention the ARJ-21. But like I say, they're patient and they're moving ahead slowly. These orders for the regional jet from the Chinese airlines sort of breathe a little bit of life into that program, so that's good. Something that's not so good, this comes from Avweb, 150,000 stranded by Thomas Cook collapse. Thomas Cook Airlines and the parent, Thomas Cook Group, have filed for bankruptcy. And reportedly, there are 150,000 customers stranded throughout the world who suddenly have no tickets back home. Not a great situation if you're out there with your family on vacation.
You know, I didn't know that much about Thomas Cook, but I always thought, gee, aren't they a travel agency? But no, they are an airline, not a huge airline. Looks like their fleet size was about 34. Pretty hard to believe that with you know, that many airplanes, you could strand that many people. But yeah, it's you know, certainly incredibly inconvenient for all those folks. Tom, what do you know about Thomas Cook?
Oh, we did a ton of coverage on this today. Like I said, Risk and Business Analytics, Relix is our parent company. They're based in London. They did a ton of coverage on this. And one thing I thought was really hilarious is that the British government is going to be deploying a lot of their government staff to help people who are already traveling, to work with employees of the company who need to get paid. They're calling it Operation Matterhorn. This is the code name for helping clean up the mess of Thomas Cook, you know, that and they're really trying to figure out what happened here. There's a lot of, you know, there are people who haven't left yet, are not affected, just don't get on the plane. But if you're already traveling, they don't want you to cut your travel short. They want you to leave as quickly as, you know, close to the departure date that you originally had as possible. So there's a lot of logistics going on here. And, you know, talk about the data we've got. We found out that a lot of the planes they had an all Airbus fleet. They had 48 Airbus planes, and almost all of them were run by lessors. So Air Cargo Germany and Air Lease Corporation are the most affected by this. So yeah, there's going to be, you know, they have to find homes for these jets.
Yes, right. It's not just a problem of, well, the company going bankrupt or the customers who are inconvenienced, but yeah, then you've got these leased aircraft, and like you say, have to find a home for them. Now, I know that bankruptcy has a different meaning in different countries of the world. Those of the United States, we're kind of familiar with Chapter 11, what we call Chapter 11 of the bankruptcy laws, which is something that's really different than what's available in other countries. Under our Chapter 11, a company can declare bankruptcy, but the company can be reorganized, restructured, debt can get canceled if it's generally in the public good that the company survive, and a court oversees that process. But a lot of other countries don't have that. And when a company declares bankruptcy, that's it. It's gone. It's done. And I don't know what the UK bankruptcy laws are like, if that means that Thomas Cook is gone for good, or if there's any possibility of a revival somehow. But as someone who's, you know, more attuned to European bankruptcy law maybe could help out.
Well, they are officially declaring insolvency, and our resident historian here, the government is comparing it to the successful repatriation of passengers after the collapse of Monarch Airways. And they said that the final cost is going to be about twice as expensive, which could be £100 million.
Yeah, but that's British nationals. There are other nationals, like people from the United States and France, who they're on their own. Britain is repatriating anybody that is a British national, but it's my understanding that anybody who was flying Thomas Cook that was not a British national is out in the cold on their own, even though they might be on a tropical island in the Caribbean.
And that in itself, I think, is fascinating. If you think about an airline going bankrupt in the U.S., I highly doubt that the U.S. government is going to go, you know, try and fix that. I think other airlines would probably offer discounted tickets and things like that. But yeah, to me, that's really kind of remarkable that the government, you know, steps in to kind of rescue people from around the world.
I also kind of find it an interesting model. It's very different than the United States, where we don't have an airline that is a travel agency or a, you know, it would be kind of the way I was understanding it, and I could be wrong. I'm getting this over the last couple of days, but it's sort of like suddenly Disney decided to start an airline to fly to Disney, and Disney was controlling. So it's just a very different model than we have here in the United States. We've got alliances where, like, hotels will become an alliance with a airline, but there's no, the hotel has an airline to fly to their resorts kind of thing. Maybe I'm misunderstanding that, but it's a very interesting model, and it's been around a lot longer than just aviation, since it's 100 plus years old.
And David, you may not recall, but we had a story here a few months ago that Disney is looking to start an airline, I think, in 2021, serving flights out of Orlando to Detroit, Chicago, LaGuardia, and LAX. And all I can say is I would hate to board one of those aircraft, look left, and see Mickey and Goofy up in the cockpit.
I was going to say, and have a Mickey Mouse pilot?
Yeah, I would turn around and head out of there. I don't care how cute they are.
Oh, dear. All right, well, we have another story from sky.com. A pilot caught on high voltage electricity line after fighter jet crashes in France. Now, I had heard that a Belgian F-16 had experienced some kind of a problem and had an accident. But I was unaware of the aftermath of this particular incident.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre. I mean, most people, when they hit the ejection seat, figure, all right, my problems are over. In this case, one pilot ejected fine. The other pilot found himself hanging from a 250,000-volt wire. And there's a picture that shows the chute hanging, or the chair and small chute hanging up in the top of it. And he's about halfway down, just hanging there. And it was apparently quite a big effort to extract him from there. They talked about evacuating the nearby town and hundreds of people being involved in the rescue. That's a pretty big deal, and you know, for good reason. That's the kind of thing where you don't want to make a mistake while you're extracting the pilot.
That's for sure.
It reminds me of a childhood memory. Well, a teenage memory. When I was at McGuire for one of their air shows, they had the 82nd Airborne parachute into the field. And in the center of the field was a radar. And it was a bad, windy day, and the Air Force proceeded to put the 82nd Airborne all over the field, up and including having one of the poor troopers get caught on the rotating radar.
Oh, no. Did he then begin rotating himself?
And he began. It was like he was on one of those swings at an amusement park.
Oh no!
Took about 10 minutes for them to get out there via truck to turn the radar off to get him down. I mean, it's as bad as the guy who is played by Mickey Rooney in D-Day, and he gets caught in the steeple in Mary St. Eglise. So I mean it. At least in those two things, you don't have electrical wires that can cause. I mean, we know what happened to Manhattan in 2005. It was a squirrel that decided to set off New York City. So you can imagine what they were thinking with a pilot sitting there with his chute on. And it's embarrassing enough he had to eject out of the aircraft. But this would be, I'm sure there's some ribbing coming from his fellow pilots.
I just hope that he wasn't well done after sitting in front of, a megawatt, radar system. You know, there's a reason microwaves, heat food up, and that's because, at those frequencies, you're exciting the water molecules in things that resemble meat. So, yeah, hopefully he was hanging much lower and not right in the main field of that radar.
Oh, for sure. Well, I guess this Belgian F-16 was on a training flight, and one of these reports said they ejected when when the jet's wing clipped a rural house, which made me wonder how that's possible. But the Belgian Defense Ministry says that the crew had reported some kind of an engine problem. So maybe they were on the way down when they clipped the house. And I'm not sure, David, if they punched out before or after they contacted the house.
Well, either way, it's not a good situation. As a general rule, a lot of times those pilots will ride it as close to the ground as they can. I mean, that's why we have 00 ejection seats. And do you want to protect the lives on the ground besides the lives in the cockpit? So they might have taken it as far as they could and in the process clipped the house as it just before it impacted the ground. If they were getting tied up in wires, they were ejecting pretty low.
One more item from AvWeb. It seems Chuck Yeager's back in the news. He's suing Airbus over a trademark issue. Max T., what's going on here?
Now, it's a good question. You know, even looking at this story, it's not really clear why would Chuck Yeager and presumably, people working with him even pursue this. But apparently he's suing them over using his name on a photo that he says was helping to promote a new helicopter design without paying him. And I guess they described him as one of the most, if not the most famous pilots of all time. Don't really understand why he's upset about that, but I guess he somehow felt that they were comparing, perhaps misleading readers into believing that he had endorsed the new helicopter. The CEO at the time apparently said something like 7 years ago, Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier, and that Airbus was now trying to break the cost barrier. Again, that doesn't really sound like a trademark infringement to me. If anything, it sounds like a compliment. But interestingly, he had previously demanded $1 million for permission to use his name in an Airbus press release after the company had released a video of him touring the factory. But apparently that didn't actually happen. So it sounds like, you know, Chuck Yeager and Airbus have, you know, mixed things up together in the past. But it's just kind of a bizarre story.
It is kind of bizarre. The most interesting thing to me in this whole story is that Chuck Yeager is 96 years old. Yeah, holy exactly. moly.
He did a supersonic flight recently.
Did he?
Ah. Yeah, the Air Force took him up and, you know, they got permission to break the sound barrier, and they did it for some commemoration.
Hmm.
So he's in really good shape.
I guess he must be, because I tell you, when I envision myself at age 96, I can't see myself suing Airbus or hiring attorneys. I mean, at that point, who cares?
That is exactly the same thought that I had as well, too. Don't you have better things to do with your time at that point in time, rather than getting aggravated? Which almost leads me to believe maybe, you know, the heirs are the ones, you know, pushing this.
Yeah.
And he's not in that good a shape.
No.
That flight was 5 years ago. They had the X-1 at the Smithsonian on the floor because they were rebuilding the Boeing thing, and they allowed him to climb in from his wheelchair while the X-1 was still on the floor so he could sit in it again. But he's pretty much wheelchair bound, and I think Mr. Trescott is kind of right that this is more along the lines of the people behind the scenes trying to eke some money out of it than it is for Mr. Yeager to profit from it.
Yeah, it really does seem like a bit of a stretch. Now, I saw him in either 2010 or 2011. He lives a couple hours from here, and I was at a local airport there when he walked into the restaurant, and he was walking under his own power then in, you know, 2010 or 2011, whichever year it was. And it was really kind of funny because the restaurant just went quiet. Nobody said a word. Everybody was just kind of watching him walk by, and, you know, nobody rushed up to say, oh, can I have your autograph? You know, it was just a very kind of respectful, oh, yeah, here's Chuck Yeager walking into this airport restaurant in Auburn, California. So kind of fun to see.
I'm not sure how I would react if I was in a restaurant and Chuck Yeager strolled in. I don't think I'd be completely calm, but especially if nobody else was fawning over him for, you know, autographs or a few words or something. But I'd probably grab my trusty recorder and thrust it at his face and see if I can get some nice comments.
Yeah, well, just keep in mind that he has a temper.
I guess Airbus is finding out.
He's one of those, you know, he's notorious for having a bit of a temper. So, but you know, and a bit of a swagger, I should say.
Yeah,
reminds me a little bit of Buzz Aldrin. Have you ever met Buzz Aldrin?
Have not.
Oh, he has that reputation too, doesn't he?
He's kind of like that. I haven't, you know, he's not belligerent in lawsuits or anything. I mean, I think he's having some kind of feud with his heirs, but I've been at Space Council meetings with him, and there'll be like executives and politicians and all these other people who are very stingy with their time. And he's, I don't know how old he is. He's getting up there, but he'll just go on a tear and no one will interrupt him. Like, he can do anything. Like, this is one of those guys. He and Chuck Yeager are of a generation where they, you know, they broke frontiers and they've got swagger in their old age, and God bless them.
Yep, they got street cred.
No. They know they can do whatever they want.
Must be nice. Sounds like fun.
Yep. All right, let's talk about the Boeing 737 MAX because, well, another week has gone by, and so it's time to talk about the Boeing 737 MAX again.
At least it's not tankers.
But, you know, hey, that could come back, David. You never know. But
yeah, I know. So, that I have no doubt.
So, Tom, you know, this is going to be such a textbook business school case in the future, I'm sure. There are so many aspects to this, so many things that are yet to play out. But you've been following this pretty closely. What kind of stands out in your mind as to, you know, what's happening right now?
Oh, yeah. I'm based in Washington, D.C., so I've been to all of the congressional hearings about 737 MAX aircraft, and there's been a lot of discussion about the FAA. I think the big thing that's going to change after this is FAA safety certification, because Boeing it bills itself as the world's largest aerospace company. They're going to be fine. You know, they really push production on the MAX, and let's disclaimer that the investigations of the two fatal crashes are ongoing, and so we'll have to wait for that. But there's, obviously the MCAS, this automated flight control that is on the MAX, was not on the previous airplane. They were able to self-certify in Boeing. You know, the FAA has a program where they delegate aircraft safety certification to companies. And it kind of makes sense because they should have the personnel who's qualified to do this, but there was not enough oversight because they filed this aircraft under the same type certification. So they said it was not significantly different enough to warrant that more thorough review. And this automatic trim, because the engines were bigger and they wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to climb without some kind of way to counteract that. So these two planes flew into nosedives. Again, the investigation is ongoing, but it looks like this flight control had quite a bit to do with it. So the safety certification process should have flagged that either for the certification, maybe a new type certification, or at least the pilots should have gotten more training on it. The Senate and, the Senate and the House have both grilled the FAA, and they've talked with pilots and they've talked with people who work in the industry, and a lot of people have been critical of this delegation process. So I'm wondering whether the FAA will probably have to keep doing it because they don't have the money or the staff to do everything in-house. So they're going to have to figure out some kind of a compromise where there can be accountability, but they can still delegate safety oversight to companies or to individuals who are employed or are paid by companies. There's got to be some kind of compromise there.
Yeah, there's no way that some degree – well, there's no way there can be no self-certification. There has to be some. It's just an impossible task otherwise. It'd probably take 10 or 20 years to certify an aircraft if the manufacturer didn't have at least some self-certification role in there. But I'm curious as to what's been the tenor of these hearings. Are our elected officials incensed? Is the FAA, groveling? What's been the tenor of these conversations?
Well, here's something up front is that nobody from Boeing has been at any of these hearings.
Really? It's just been the FAA?
Well, it's been a lot of people, the families of the victims and, people from industry groups like pilots, flight attendants, people from the FAA, people who used to work at the National Transportation Safety Board. There's been a lot of people at these hearings, but nobody from Boeing. And Boeing Chairman Dennis Muhlenberg has been invited to attend a House hearing, the House Transportation Committee, and no word yet from Boeing on whether he's going to come, but he would be the first. And other reporters I've talked with, because every aviation reporter has been covering this. And Boeing has not – they should be more penitent, I think. They have not really injected the empathy into their discussion about this is what I've – the general discussion I'm hearing. And, they are – they don't want to get ahead of it. They haven't been saying a whole lot, actually. They've just been, saying they're working with the FAA, that they're working with, regulators, that they're making sure that this is safe to fly again. But there are people, families of the victims. I went to a hearing a few months ago, and they said that that nobody from Boeing has directly contacted them. There was a story, Boeing announced today that they're going to give about $146,000 to, for every victim, all the 346 victims who were lost in these aircraft. So they've set up funds, and they're talking about some kind of charity that they could do. But apparently they haven't, according to the representatives of most of the families, that nobody from Boeing has directly contacted them. Ethiopian Airlines and Lion Air have both contacted the families. They sent letters of condolences. But I haven't, you know, I've asked Boeing about this and they haven't said whether or not they have.
I wonder if that's because they're concerned, they being Boeing, is concerned about exposing themselves to more liability by having these conversations.
It's very possible, yeah. But still, it's...
But it doesn't help the image, the perception.
Yeah, it really is optics. I don't want to, you know, I work very well with people at Boeing. I have, you know, it's they're part of my beat and they give, you know, they're very responsive. But it's all about the optics, really. I mean, it's this is a, how often does everyone know about an aviation story? This is one of those stories where everyone knows about it. It is a global grounding of aircraft. So the image, you know, Boeing really has some image work to do. So I've been covering the regulation side of it, and there's going to be a lot of hearings on the Hill this week about it. Tomorrow, there's an FAA hearing in the Senate about air traffic control, but, you know, it'll probably come up because it's the Senate Commerce Committee. They'll probably ask, you know, the Aviation Subcommittee, they'll probably ask something about it. On Wednesday, the House Appropriations Committee is going to have a hearing about FAA safety certification. And on Thursday, the House Transportation Committee is going to have a hearing about FAA reauthorization that was passed last year. So each of these is opportunity for 737 MAX aircraft to come up again. So this could be a busy week for news on that. You know, added to the fact that Steve Dixon and Dan, you know, the FAA is in Montreal today for the ICAO meetings. So they're meeting with the international aviation safety community.
Right, because this is the issue of different regulatory agencies across the world not acting in lockstep with the FAA, correct?
Yeah, because EASA has said that they might not – there's discussions about even if the FAA clears 737 MAX aircraft to fly, then they might not – you know, the airlines might not want to do it right away. The other regulatory agencies at other countries might not do it right away. So this is a big part of the discussions that they're going to have while they're at ICAO.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see how those work out. As far as the FAA and changing the process for self-certification, do you have any sense for how that would come about? In other words, would the FAA just be kind of given marching orders, go fix it and come back and tell us what you're going to do? Or would they be instructed by the, you know, the aviation committees as to take specific actions? Any sense of that?
Well, the Department of Transportation has a committee. I'm told by someone who's on the committee that it's going to be similar to the NextGen, the group that planned NextGen. They've gotten together a lot of people in aviation safety, and they're going to get together and they're going to come up with something to approach this. So they're going to approach safety certification in a similar way that they did NextGen. So this is going to be ongoing. This is going to take a few years, I think. It's you know, Congress could give marching orders, but it would be strange because in the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2012, Congress told the FAA to delegate more. So they wanted to have these aircraft get out the door faster. They wanted to take some of the burden off the FAA. And now, but at the same time, in the years after that, there was Department of Transportation Inspector General reports and GAO reports that came out and said this might not be a great idea because the FAA, being short-staffed as it is, can't ensure quality. They can't ensure accountability. They're delegating to these companies, and they're just kind of relying that they're doing the right thing.
When the 737 MAX is flying again and you had an opportunity to be on one of the first flights for some vacation or some trip that you needed to take, would you do it?
Probably. I'm on the spot, probably. Steve Dixon has said that he wants to fly on one of the test flights. He's, you know, he was a Delta pilot, I think. Well, he was a pilot and he worked at Delta recently, and now he's head of FAA. He says he wants to fly on one of the test flights.
Yes. David, what do you say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anyone who's listened to UAV Digest says I'm perfectly willing to volunteer to fly in a unmanned
the first urban air mobility. Yeah,
and a remotely piloted vehicle. But I, you know, one of those things. Here's a little logic, though. I wouldn't worry about the test flight. You know, everybody and their brother would be watching the first or second test flight. A year or so later, when things are back to normal, then is that when you start wondering when the next shoe drops? You know, I wouldn't have any problem getting on one of the first flights, but I have a feeling they'll get it fixed. I have faith in, you know, if another 737 MAX goes down, I think that'll be the end of Boeing.
That would be it. Yeah, they would be toast, I would think, yeah.
So, I mean, they have no wiggle room anymore to fail. I don't know. Mr. Trescott, would you get in it?
Well, you know, I've already been on one before. Of course, I was before the crashes, and so I didn't realize I was flying an unsafe airplane back then. No, it certainly is going to be safer than it was before. So, yes, of course, I would fly it again.
I'm told this is an anomaly, actually. I've talked with people who work in safety certification, and they were not eager to beat up on Boeing. And I think that's very fair. You know, Boeing is a giant company, but this particular project seems that the MAX seemed like they really wanted to compete with Airbus. So they wanted to get this out the door as soon as possible. And I think that we'll find out what happened, but it's not, you know, because they filed it, this new, you know, modified plane under an old type certificate. And I'm told that, no, the safety certification is thankfully more thorough usually. So this seems like an anomaly, but still the fact that it could happen is worrisome.
Yeah. Sometimes these things can have interesting origins. I mean, one of the classic examples in the, you know, the quality culture teachings is, or one of the examples is the CEO of a company says to the, you know, next in command, I want to have, you know, product X out by the end of the quarter. And the second in command goes to the next down the line. The CEO says we have to have this out by, you know, and it kind of can get amplified to the point where it gets down to the working level and it's like a direct command that, you know, you're going to do, you know, you're going to perform this way. And sometimes that can lead to quality issues. I'm not saying that's the case here, but it's just an example of how sometimes these kinds of things can happen. But there's an article in the New York Times. It's called What Really Brought Down the Boeing 737 MAX. They say malfunctions caused two deadly crashes, but an industry that puts unprepared pilots in the cockpit is just as guilty. And I think they're referring to the fact that some pilots, when early on in this scenario, when kind of presented with, okay, they didn't know about the MCAS, but given the conditions they were presented with, how would they have reacted, and would they have known how to react? And we've talked to pilots who said, "Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, these other pilots didn't throw the switches, didn't shut it off. It's, you know, uncontrolled, you know, stabilizer. You know, there's process for that." But do you think the New York Times is onto something here when they talk about that maybe we're not designing aircraft for kind of the lowest common denominator of pilots, and maybe that's something we should do? What do you think about that?
I'm certainly sympathetic to the pilots who've been flying the MAX and those who've, you know, not had as much training as might be desirable. And yeah, I think that in situations like this where you have, you know, a complex system where it's not clear what the cause of the problem is, that can be really stressful for people in the cockpit, and, you know, it can be a little difficult for them to troubleshoot. And I think we've read somewhere that, you know, they had something like 40 seconds to, figure it out. I got to tell you, 40 seconds is not a whole lot of time to figure out a complex issue. And I'm not sure that I would, succeed in that particular environment. So, yeah, I'm pretty sympathetic to the pilots. Ideally, they would have gotten better training and had a less complex system.
I've been covering this since the Lion Air crash, and I was actually, remember, I was at an FAA meeting and I said I have to leave because there was a crash in Indonesia. And so I read that story, and I think that there's definitely something to it that you have to design. You know, safety means that even the person with the least experience will be safe using it. And I've heard pilots say that there wasn't enough training and that you have to make sure that's, you know, pilots are aware. But, you know, I think that they dwell a little bit too much in that New York Times story on foreign pilot error. I think that there's a lot of discussion about the problems that Lion Air had faced in the past because they were grounded. You know, the FAA would not take flights from Lion Air because of their maintenance troubles. So they were suspended for a while. So that was through my mind. I thought, well, maybe this is a maintenance problem because they had their air sensors. The sensors on the side of the plane would tell the computer, okay, you have to trim down now. So I thought it was a maintenance problem. And no, the pilot training problem could also be part of it. So I think there's definitely something there. I think that the story dwells quite a bit on it, though.
And speaking of Lion Air and Indonesia, I guess that it looks like they're going to fault the aircraft design and the FAA's oversight in terms of the Lion Air crash. And I'm not sure that they are, pinning any blame on their pilots.
Yeah, I heard that these pilots were, they said that they had thousands of hours of flight hours. So they seemed like they were experienced enough. But if there wasn't thorough enough training with automated flight controls, then that's a problem. You can't just have, you have to have one of the things that Boeing actually, there's a Russian company that's suing Boeing for fraud. Because they said one of the big reasons that the 737 MAX was such a hot item is that airlines would not have had, supposedly wouldn't have had to train pilots as long.
Right.
Because when you train pilots, you have to pay them. You have to, they're out and they can't fly and they have to do, you have to pay them that whole time. So it was billed as cheaper because they wouldn't need as much training for this, the MAX, which was not significantly different than the old version of the 737.
Yeah. Training is expensive. It's a cost. It doesn't generate any revenue. Pilots in a simulator. But maybe as one final issue, unless you guys have something else, is we got an email from Ken, who listens to the show. He's a 737 cargo pilot. And this is actually another story from the New York Times. Boeing board to call for safety changes after 737 MAX crashes. And I hadn't heard this before, but apparently the board of directors at Boeing, who you would think would have a very key role in terms of what happens next at the Boeing company, but the board of directors created a board of directors committee to look at this and make recommendations for changes at Boeing that would impact safety. So I think that's going to be an interesting result to watch for. All right. Well, Tom, that's a lot on the 737 MAX. There's other things going on in other countries. Airline mergers in Canada. We have some activities going on there, do we?
Yeah, there's the two largest airlines in Canada. Air Canada is the largest and WestJet is the second largest. They're both going through big deals that could give them more resources for their international expansion. Now, both of these are planning more routes to Europe, more routes across the Americas, and thanks in part to a different Boeing plane, the 787, the big wide bodies that are easier to fly transatlantic routes. So WestJet is close to being acquired by 1X Partners, which is a Canadian private equity firm, and it would completely buy WestJet's debt. So they would have all these new financial resources for their expansion. And Air Canada would buy Transat, which is the parent company of Air Transat. That's a tourism operator. And they do holiday packages. They own property in Mexico. They would have new aircraft, and they would have this whole plug-in to the Transat tourism packages. So the two largest airlines in Canada could soon be, the competition could be heating up between them, and there could be a lot more options for Canadian passengers.
Sounds a little like Thomas Cook in terms of, an airline and I guess you call that right vertical integration.
Yeah, well, I was wondering what was going to happen to Transat, and now we know because they're being bought. So that's one way to answer your financial problems.
Another topic that we've talked a lot about is, well, you could call it green aviation. I think in years past, we talked a lot about biofuels, and there was a lot of testing, it seemed, of 50-50 blends of biofuel and conventional fuel. And that was pretty active in the press. More recently, attention seems to be focused to a pretty large degree on electric aircraft. That's something that we've talked about many times over the past months. I guess you had a climate strike in D.C. where you are, Tom.
Yeah, there was one in New York as well. The United Nations Climate Action Summit was today, so they used it as a chance to call attention to climate change. And protesters blocked intersections, and this is almost reminiscent of the Hong Kong protests where they shut down the Hong Kong International Airport to gain international attention. So, transportation protests, when you're trying to disrupt daily life, they've got a history. Like Gandhi used them, Martin Luther King used them. And, so to get people's attention, that does the trick. So this is the historical context to it. So people were upset about it with their commute, but it got their attention. Yeah, a lot of protesters there were a few dozen arrested, and most of them were let go midday. They were trying to disrupt the morning commute. They were out of detention around 12:30 p.m. So, there's been a lot of movement. It's been affecting aviation more recently. Have you heard about the Heathrow, the attempts to disrupt flights at Heathrow?
Yes, with drones.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's transportation protests have impact, but you have to think about, you don't want to alienate people while you're doing it. You want to get attention, but you have to be strategic about it. So, yeah, there's something to think about there. And then there's the whole flight shaming. There's the fly shaming pressure, like, was this trip really necessary? There's been more attention to aviation emissions. And electric aviation could be a way to address that. It's not a free lunch. The batteries wouldn't eliminate emissions. Oil would still be somewhere in the supply chain. You'd be moving instead of if airplanes are not going to be completely battery powered for decades. Safran has said that, wide bodies that carry hundreds of people will not be completely battery powered for quite a while, for safety reasons, for energy storage capabilities. The science and the regulation side of it just isn't there yet. But if you move the energy generation to a power plant on the ground, you can at least scrub the emissions more effectively than you can when it's on a plane in the air.
Yeah, there's aviation seems to be a target, an easy target, I think, for people. And that's not to suggest that aviation shouldn't be greener or couldn't be greener. I think it could be and should be. But I don't know if the attention on aviation is really proportionate to the contribution that aviation makes towards, greenhouse gases. But it kind of doesn't matter. If there's a perception that aviation is contributing to our ecological problems, then, the industry has to react. But I think the industry, has reacted. When you look at the efficiencies of the 737 MAX aircraft, of the 320 family NEOs, you're talking about significantly reduced fuel consumption, emissions, and all that. But I don't know. It feels like aviation doesn't get enough credit for that.
It's not as well. It's actually also the contrails, all the white streaks through the sky. Those are technically greenhouse. Those contribute to the greenhouse effects, even though they're just dust and water. But it does the trick. But there a lot of companies are investing in electric flight. Like Safran and Boeing are both investing a ton of money in electric flight and batteries. And so a lot of companies are getting involved. There's definitely a ton of investment. It's not going to replace wide bodies and commercial flight anytime soon. But smaller scale electric flight, like pilot trainers, is one. By Aerospace is one example. They're a company that's trying to make a electric battery powered plane for trainers, so that at least the money, at least the fuel spent on training flights, when you're trying to get all those flight hours for pilots, it'll be battery powered. So most electric flight within the next couple decades, I'm going to wager, can only carry about 1 to 5 people per flight. They're not going to be very big. They're not going to have a ton of energy. So I think until the early 2030s, at least, that's the most that a battery powered plane will be able to do. But there's a lot of energy saving. Like the Gear turbofan engine is another good example where they're trying to get more air into the turbofan engine so that it'll be more fuel efficient.
And I have a theory. My theory is that in the past, what's the past? I don't know, the past 10 years or so, maybe longer if you include the development time fully. But in the past, incentive has been economic from the standpoint of cost of oil, fuel prices. And so I think that has been the driver towards improving the efficiency of aircraft. But my theory is that in the future, going forward, you know, unless there's some big event where oil prices go crazy again, but in the future, I think the pressure will still be there, just as strong, if not stronger, but from a different source, from the standpoint of people wanting to address issues of climate, global warming, and all of those things. I think that's going to be the big driver towards future efficiency improvements. I think that's – do you like my theory? Does it hold water?
Yeah, sure. It definitely could, because it's all about consumer perception. You know, just as much as whether passengers feel like the plane is safe, they're going to wonder, was this trip necessary? I mean, maybe not as often. You know, safety will have the greater priority, which is why – you know, one of the reasons that a battery-powered flight is not going to take over anytime soon, but they'll definitely think about it.
And the other thing is I wish people would have more data, especially when you think about things like flight shaming, right? Someone says, you know, oh, you flew on an airplane and that was all wasteful. Well, what were the alternatives? What was the efficiency, the carbon contribution of those alternatives in total? People don't, I don't know, I don't think they look at the whole picture and include all the drivers. So you'll see someone say, well, electric, you know, I've got this electric vehicle or this electric whatever, it's zero emission. Well, what about the generation of the electricity that charged the, you know, that stuff doesn't get added in. It's not a complete picture. So I think that aviation, the industry, I think could maybe do more to make the public more aware of the efficiencies. Because I think in some cases you find that flying by an airplane is actually greener than, you know, on a per passenger basis than some alternative. But I don't know. I think there's a lot of a lot of public relations work that's that needs to be done in the future.
I think the urban air mobility, the flying taxis are going to face that, because that's a whole new class of aircraft and they will be completely battery powered. So they'll have to do some convincing there about whether that's necessary or not.
Yeah, that's a whole another nut right there to crack, I think, for a lot of different reasons. But well, Tom, did you mention to me once that you're working on a personal newsletter?
I've been thinking about it. You mentioned Future Flight News. Future Flight News is a website I maintain about the engineering side of things. When I was at Aerospace America, I was doing more engineering side of things and the technology of it. Now I do more the business side of it. So once in a while, I'll write stories about new types of aircrafts, like supersonic aircraft, supersonic business jets, or urban air mobility. So I'm very interested in, I'm skeptical of the business of urban air mobility and the, you know, the sustainability of the lithium-ion batteries, but I'm very interested in how they're designed.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting aspects to that whole thing. We had that, that horrible accident with the boat full of divers. There's at least some suspicions that that fire and that huge loss of life was the result of everybody trying to charge their lithium-ion batteries in an electrical system that wasn't designed for that kind of thing, so... Yeah, lithium-ion batteries continue to be in the news, and not always with a good story. You know, there again, there's some work to be done.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Tom, where are the best places to follow you online?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Tom Risen. I was one of the first people joined up in 2006, so I get to use my own name.
Yay!
Joined early enough, I'm on Cirium and Flight Global. Cirium is for subscribers, but we have a content sharing partnership with Flight Global, so flightglobal.com. But Cirium is a separate company now. And if you are interested in the great data sets and analytics and flight routes and fleet information, then go to Cirium.com, C-I-R-I-U-M, and you can do a trial subscription, I believe. And especially, it's great for investors, great for people in the industry. I highly recommend it.
Very good. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thank you.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see. Max Trescott, what have you got for us this episode?
Well, no surprise, I have been podcasting away. And if folks want to check out Aviation News Talk podcast, episode 122 is up. And it's that time of year. One of my favorite topics to talk about, and that's NATCA's Archie League Awards. So NATCA, of course, is the Union for Air Traffic Controllers. The Archie League Awards are where they recognize controllers with the biggest saves, or the, you know, times where they've really done a lot to help out a pilot in trouble. So they held their annual banquet last week in Las Vegas, and I picked seven of the roughly dozen awards that they handed out and highlighted them, complete with the audio. So people can listen in on how two airliners nearly had a midair, both as they were departing Chicago last year, and hear about an F-16 that was at bingo fuel, running out of gas and running out of options, a 172 that was picking up ice, and, you know, all kinds of things like that. So it's a great episode, and I think it really just highlights how lucky we are to have such amazingly great controllers working in the, you know, the FAA.
Yeah, they are amazing. Those that I have come to know personally are just really impressive individuals. Was Archie some specific controller?
He is. He was considered one of the first controllers. So his name was Archie League, and he was, as I recall, at St. Louis. And he had a wheelbarrow, some binoculars, and flags. And each day he would kind of wheel his stuff out toward the middle of the field, and he'd sit there all day, wave his flags, and land the aircraft. So that's why the awards honor him, since he was recognized as the first controller here in the country.
Very good. All right. Well, I'm headed up to Maine in a few days for the Collings Foundation, their Wings of Freedom tour. They're going to be in Lewiston, Maine. I'm going to catch up with our main man, Micah, and I think Captain Jeff, too, and see if we can go see some restored B-17 and B-24. Let's see what else. A Mustang, and I think, David, do they have a P-42? Maybe that's part of the tour.
They have a P-40, a P-51, a B-25, a B-24, and a B-17.
Maybe you should come with us. And so that's going to be...
I've been on the B-24 and the B-17, so you guys have a grand old time. I'm bucking for the P-40 or the P-51 at this point.
Yeah, since you've been on the... if I can... I'm going to see if I can get a flight on the B-24. I think that would be... that would be great. But they're, so that's this week. They're going to Nashua, New Hampshire, September 27th. And then Bradley, September 30th. Why am I going to Maine if they're going to come to Connecticut on the 30th? Then they're going to be in New York, White Plains, October 3rd, over to Morristown, New Jersey, October 7th. And they go on to Maryland and the Carolinas. So we'll have a link in the show notes to the Wings of Freedom tour. Even if you don't go for a flight, just going to spend some time inside some of these restored bombers is really kind of a fascinating thing. And it's a great thing to take your kids to if you have the opportunity. Well, speaking about restorations, we got a notice from Scott Timms about the 35th Annual Commemorative Air Force Wings Over Houston Air Show. That's coming up Saturday and Sunday, October 19th and 20th at Ellington Airport. And they've got a great lineup. The U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds, the Canadian Snowbirds are there, the fantastic F-35A Lightning II demo team. That's the one I saw at the New York Air Show. That's fairly spectacular. And that plane looks better, I think, David, in flight than it does static on the ground. I don't know why. It's the lines seem better.
It's the landing gear. It's got very stalky landing gear because of the internal bomb, the internal weapons bay.
Ah.
So it sits very, it's kind of like the F-117. The F-117 on the ground looked like a cockroach because it was very flat. I used to call them stink bugs.
That's even better.
But because of the internal weapons bay, it sits very high off the ground. So you have a very low profile, but with very, very stalky legs. It's kind of the reason why I like the C version the best. The bigger wings, the bigger tailplanes, and the beefier landing gear with the dual nose wheel. It looks more proportional, but the Air Force version and the Marine Corps versions look very stalky on the ground.
Hmm. I always thought that was an interesting, you know, design issue, because really you want to design for functionality, but you can't completely rule out aesthetics either. Even when you're talking about a fighter, you know, a military aircraft, where you can say that it just should be purely based on function. But still, you know, there's competitions and people, you know, make selections. And I don't know. I just think that the aesthetics sort of has to play at least a little bit of a role.
I think the aesthetic is partly stealth influenced because it's got the single engine. I took a picture of it when I was at the Paris Air Show, and all you could see was the engine, you know, like from the bottom. It's designed to be small and kind of minimize the sight profile a little bit.
And the old saying that if it looks good, it flies good.
Yes, there's that too. So the Commemorative Air Force Wings Over Houston Air Show, website is wingsoverhouston.com. And if I understood correctly, Launchpad Marzari is planning on attending and representing Airplane Geeks at the air show. So look for him. I was going to say, just look for the guy that towers over everybody else. But this is in Texas, and I think they all tower over. I think a Texan in the midst of Texans doesn't stand out. Speaking of Launchpad Marzari, we have the fifth episode in his adventure purchasing and bringing this interesting airplane into the United States. And this time Launchpad talks to us about some of the challenges of importing this aircraft from Canada.
Plane Buy, Episode 5, Importing a Fighter. Not really. Okay, you're bringing an airplane into the U.S. to stay. There's an easy way and there's a hard way. I was fortunate enough to take the easy way. The easy way is to have the point of sale be in America. That is to have the owner of the airplane deliver the aircraft to you before the sale. So, in my case, we have a Canadian pilot flying a Canadian registered airplane on a Canadian license with Canadian insurance into America. This is something that happens every day and it's pretty easy. Doing it this way made sense and saved a mountain of paperwork and headaches. The hard way is to buy the airplane in a foreign country. This means that you have to register the airplane in a foreign country, but you may not have a pilot's license in that country, or even a permanent place of residence, so the host country can get all the taxes it's supposed to get. Or you could deregister the airplane in the host country and then try to fly it in on a temporary U.S. registrations. Oh, this is more paperwork. And who's going to insure you to fly this temporary registered airplane without any inspections across the international border? No, 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 no. Let's go back to doing it the easy way. Okay, you're going to fly an airplane into America. First thing you need is your U.S. Customs and Border Patrol airplane and vessel sticker from Homeland Security. Allow 18 days for delivery. It came in 4 days. This decal you'll need regardless of whether you're buying an airplane or just flying it in for the weekend and flying it back to Canada. This little 1-inch by 1-inch sticker is stuck on the window, and you should proudly display it, as it's only $28 and represents the cheapest thing you're going to buy during this whole importing process. So display it with pride. It'll make you happy. The next smart thing you should do is hire a customs broker. They're not cheap, but they are worth every dime you pay for them. They file all the correct paperwork in your name. They tell you what to do, what to say, where to say it, and when to say it. More on how helpful they are in a moment. Now, I went up to Canada so that I could fly down with the Canadian owner to get some dual time in the aircraft, and also because my Canadian seller's English was weak, as English was his second language. He spoke mostly French and wanted someone to handle the radios and deal with the FBOs and the customs on the way down. It was a good idea and a fun flight for both of us. So what does the timetable look like? You start in Canada, specifically Montreal. You tell the customs brokers at least 48 hours out, or in our case, more like a week out, when you're planning to enter the U.S. That gives them a chance to get all the paperwork together. You have to notify U.S. Customs 24 hours out and make an appointment for a one-hour window at a specific entry point. In the morning, you call them an hour out to confirm that you're going to arrive somewhere within your authorized window. So we go wheels up from Montreal. Montreal Air Traffic Control hands us over to the U.S. We cross the border. We land in Burlington, Vermont. Once we land, we request to taxi to the U.S. Customs. You park on the U.S. Customs ramp. Now, you're not allowed to get out of the airplane. The customs agent comes out with a Geiger counter and an explosive sniffer, sweeps the outside of your airplane. Then he asks you to step out of the airplane. He then sweeps you with the Geiger counter and the explosive sniffing device. Then he gets in the airplane and runs the Geiger counter over everything and takes a look at your cargo, which in this case was a box of spare parts and the overnight bag. It was all pretty easy. But because this aircraft has been identified as a former military aircraft by the Department of Homeland Security, they assume that all warbirds must be fighters. So the agent stands there and has to ask me the questions. The agent asks, are there any hard points on the aircraft? No, sir. Any drop tanks? No, sir. Does this aircraft have any internal weapons? No, sir, it does not. Does it have any mounting points for weapons on the inside of the aircraft? No, it does not. It's a trainer. Having asked those mandatory questions, he looks at the outside of the aircraft, and then he goes, you're right. Let's go inside. Hey, 3 points for logic and common sense. Once inside, we go through the normal showing of passports and passport stamps that you'd expect when flying or driving into a country. Now, here's where the customs broker comes in. The CBP officer asks, do you have a customs broker? I say yes. And he says, excellent, one moment. Then walks into the back and pulls your file. He comes out with a manila folder that has all the paperwork already stamped, paid for, authorized, spindled, notarized, duplicated and triplicate. 3 stamps and 2 signatures later, we're done. The customs broker has proven their worth. The CBP officers love it when you use a customs broker, as there are fees and bonds and paperwork that must be placed together against the aircraft before it can come in. If you don't have this, all of this can be a major hassle if you have to do it right at the counter and can take a considerable amount of time and you may not do it correctly. All in all, it took us less than 3 minutes to get the inspection and the paperwork signed and approved. We asked if we could do fueling on the customs ramp and they said, sure, call for fuel. You can do it right here. Do you need to borrow a radio? The CBP station at Burlington was cleaner than most FBOs and could not have been politer. Hats off to this entry point. We were on the ground for less than an hour, and that included getting fuel. Let's hear it for the easy way. Yay! The rest of the day and the next day, we flew the airplane down to Texas, which was a typical cross country. Once on the ground, you notify the escrow company that the plane is at the point of delivery. And the point of sale has taken place. They file the paperwork to deregister the airplane in Canada, release the funds to the seller. Now it's starting to look like a house sale. See episode 3. The DAR takes possession of your paperwork and you start all the paperwork to get the airplane registered in America. So, what did we learn, aviation fans? One, in the eyes of Homeland Security, all military planes are fighters. Two, CBP officers use common sense and are a pleasure to work with. Three, having the foreign owner deliver the aircraft is so much easier. Four, customs brokers help you with the sale and are worth the money. Five, escrow companies were extremely easy to work with and really were worth the money also. Next episode, registering the airplane in America and first flight under its new tail number. This is your reporter at large, frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. Very good. I guess that sounds like that went pretty smoothly. Max Trescott, have you ever been involved in a foreign sale transaction, either coming in or going out?
We're talking about airplanes now here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to reveal any other activities I might be involved in.
Let's stick to flight.
No, I'm kidding. No, I actually talked with Launchpad over the weekend for a while about all the fun he's having with the aircraft. And yeah, it's definitely far more complex than I would have imagined bringing in an aircraft of that type from another country. And he did a good job of laying out exactly what it takes to do that. So yeah, no, hands off to him. I think he's having a great time.
Yeah, it's almost like the task of getting it here and getting it registered is, almost as, well, probably not, but it sounds almost as exciting as the aircraft itself.
Well, I think sometimes acquiring an airplane is a bit of an intellectual challenge that people enjoy because sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's not. I was talking with a gentleman last night who's buying a business jet. And we were talking about, why he was buying it and different uses for it and, different ways that he could put it up for charter operation. And boy, he talked, for quite a long time about, different insurance amounts, which range, by the way, from $28,000 a year to $60,000 a year to $120,000 a year, depending upon different permutations of who is allowed to fly the aircraft. And, based on where the aircraft was located and if it was hangared, in various states, how much that was going to cost because of state taxes. And, it's a complex problem especially when you start looking at more expensive aircraft to kind of figure out, all right, how do we make this work cost effectively with all the many different, parameters that you need to optimize.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm glad Launchpad is being as successful as he is, at least so far. I guess this, coming up, this is probably the last stage in the process, wouldn't it be, to get it formally registered in the U.S.? And then after that, he should be all set.
Yeah, exactly. Then he can attach weapons and he'll be good to go.
Yeah. All right. Hey, we've got something that I think it's a cool story. It doesn't have anything to do with aviation. Well, it does only a little bit. Last episode, we listened to Micah, and he called his friend Eric Rybeck his Kreplech brother, and we didn't really know what that meant. I mean, if you listen to that, in context, you could get the idea that it's some kind of a close relationship, but I didn't know what that meant. So Eric responded and gave us this little explanation.
Hi, Max and David. This is Eric Rybeck in Red Hook, New York. On episode 569, our main man Micah had a great recap of his year in aviation. He was kind enough to mention me as I accompanied him for both Innovations in Flight and the Spurwing fly-in. Two things he said raised questions for you, which I thought I'd address. Indeed, foamer is a term sometimes applied to those who chase trains. Whomever coined it did not mean it as a compliment, as it referred to guys who foam at the mouth when they see a rare or a special locomotive. But over time, many railroad enthusiasts have taken it on as a badge of honor. Now, I'm really not a foamer, but I've always had an affinity for trains and trolleys, and that inspired me to research and write the Rail USA Museums and Trips Guides, which Micah mentioned. What did stump you was when Micah referred to me as his Kreplech brother. As you correctly stated, Kreplech is a Jewish dumpling, usually with a meat or potato filling, and it can be served boiled in chicken soup or by itself pan-fried. So Micah and I met about 30 years ago when I was volunteering as a DJ at a university radio station in Portland, Maine. Micah and I soon realized we liked a lot of the same music, so I invited him to join me as an occasional co-host. We started hanging out and also realized we had a lot of food loves in common, especially Jewish delis. Well, we developed a nice on-air repartee, and at the time, the Car Talk show was popular on public radio, and it featured the Real Brothers, Tom and Ray Magliozzi, who referred to themselves as Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. Well, I guess one morning on the show, I was enjoying the shtick Micah and I were doing and announced that heretofore we would be known as Frickin' Frack, the Kreplach Brothers. Well, it stuck, and that's what we've been ever since. Thanks to Micah and his involvement with the Airplane Geeks podcast, I've become just a little geeky about airplanes myself, and I'm grateful to him and to both of you for that.
All right, now we know. I didn't know that it was such a, you know, personal thing between the two of them. So there's a little insight, something we didn't know about Micah and Eric.
Thanks, Eric, for taking the time to record that, because when I heard it, I was like, oh, cool. There was more there than we were implying, Max. So
yeah,
we sit corrected, but. Thanks to both of you for contributing that. And it's okay, Eric, you can say you're a foamer. There are other people on the show who definitely like choo-choos, but you didn't hear that from me.
All right.
Tom, you're not a millennial, are you?
I am just at the start of the millennial generation. I was born in the early 80s, yes.
Uh-oh, okay. So last episode, our guest... who shall remain unnamed, and one of the hosts here, who shall rename, well, me, made some disparaging remarks about millennials, kind of just, you know, poking fun, because you got to have a good time poking fun. But we heard from Mark Newton, our longtime listener, very engaged with the podcast. Mark's provided a lot of good thoughts and emails and ideas over the years, really. And he didn't appreciate the some of the references, but he also educated me a little bit, because I thought millennials were younger, a little bit younger than this, because Mark says that millennials are now about to enter their 40s. Wow, he says they're in middle management with two kids and a mortgage. And they are absolutely straight up, no fooling, exhausted by the last 20 years of ignorant, condescending, demeaning, stereotyping BS that's been gushing nonstop out of the boomers. And then Mark goes on from there. So, all right. So I think I'm going to, God, I can't believe I'm saying, I think I'm going to officially kind of lay off the millennials a little bit. And because they're an older, more mature group than I thought, or becoming so.
I'm in my late 30s. Yeah, I'm getting there.
Oh.
But I tell you, I remember being a general news reporter when I was doing more general news. If something had millennial in the title or the keyword, people would pitch you stuff. It was a buzzword, you know?
Yeah.
And I get it. It's tempting because you're a daily news reporter. You need to churn out stories. If you say millennial this, millennial that, generational stories are, you have to use your, you know, methodology and make sure that the data is good. But there's a lot of data out there that isn't good. And some people will just get tempted and say, fine, someone sent me this, I'll write a generational story. It's tempting.
Yeah. So I started thinking about not making cracks about millennials, which led me to thinking about cracks about podcasters. And so I asked a group of podcast creators for some of the jokes, references, things that they've heard about podcasters, and I got a really good collection. So here's a few. The first one is, what do you call five friends who get together to share a brain and talk about it? Podcasters.
Well, and that's assuming they're not drinking, which, you know, some of the people on these shows do that as well, too.
I was going to say, there's one show that's a important aspect of.
That's true.
Which gets confused with us.
Another one was this quote from another podcaster. I'm more concerned about what my podcast ratings and reviews say about me than what my mom says about me.
That's pretty funny.
And then this is one of my favorites. I like talking by myself in padded rooms. I'm not crazy. I'm a podcaster.
Boy, is that not you?
I know. I'm surrounded by padding in this room right here. I'm not arrogant. I'm a podcaster. That's a good one. And I think I've heard several podcasts that are similar to this. This one is, I don't have anything to say, but I sound pretty good. and then this one. The great thing about podcasting is the ability to edit what I say. Some people think I should take more advantage of that feature.
That's great.
Yeah, sometimes the editing gets pretty heavy. And then this last one. You know that old joke, you have a face for radio? Well, radio didn't want me either, so I had to revert to podcasting.
The ugly truth comes out.
There it is. That's why I'm not doing video. Oh, geez. All right. Well, so with that, invite all of you to get introspective and laugh at yourself from time to time. I think that's healthy. And as I said, I'll maybe not laugh so much about millennials if I can help it.
Laugh at my little brother. He's 10 years younger than me.
All right. I can't keep track of the Gen X, Gen Y, the millennial. Oh, this is too confusing for me.
Hey, yeah, it's a buzzword.
Watch what you say about us Gen Ys.
Is that you, David?
So, yeah, I'm that age where we don't get any respect whatsoever.
Yeah, okay. All right, we'll have to work on
that. We don't
even
get picked on. We just get ignored.
Oh, that's worse than being picked on. All right, so let's wrap this up. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest was Tom Risen, an aviation reporter who covers airlines and electric flight and regulation at Cirium, Cirium. And that's the website as well, .com, right, Tom?
Yes, sir.
You can reach us, and thanks a lot, Tom. We really appreciate it, and enjoy your insights on some of these issues. There's probably about 50 or 60 other topics we could talk to you about. But
well, I'd love to come back. Let me know.
Maybe another time. Yes, for sure. You can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Of course, you can visit airplanegeeks.com for show notes. Also, tell you how to find us on social media, how to subscribe to the podcast. There's an about page. You can learn more about each of us, a few tidbits. Maybe we should amend Micah's write-up to include Kriplak Brothers. And there's even a donate button if you'd like to help pay for this little endeavor. We want to thank all of those who have contributed. It means a great deal to us. As I've said in the past, we don't just take that money and put it in our pockets or go out to dinner. We use it for advancing the podcast, for promoting the podcast, and we try to put that money to good use. So we appreciate all that support us. Show notes for this episode, if you want to go straight there, are at airplanegeeks.com/571. And David Vanderhoof, where does everybody find you online these days?
Well, you can find me at our Slack listener team. You can join the fun there by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook, if you can spell Vanderhoof. And you can find me at the American Helicopter Museum in Westchester. And last but not least, you can find me talking about drones with that guy Max Flight on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest.
That's right. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, this week you can find me doing my annual recurrent training in the Vision Jet. So that's going to be a heck of a lot of fun to be out there for a while. But other than that, you can find me in the usual places. Go to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page, and you can shoot me an email. Or if you want to leave a listener question, just click on listener questions and record your voice there.
Cool. And Tom, who are you on Twitter again?
Tom Risen does T-O-M-R-I-S-E-N. Years from now, I'll tell you about my brother's generation. They're going to have, they have to add all these numbers and everything else to all these other services because they didn't join as early as I did.
Yes, yes. I think I joined a year behind you, but I was still lucky also.
I got Vanderhoof. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but how many Vanderhoofs are there?
There's a Vanderhoof International Air Show.
In Canada, right?
Yeah. So I, there's plenty, but...
You know, we should go to that some year.
It's on my bucket list. I want to go there and say, hi, thank you for having this air show in my honor.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation, mostly, on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.